I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're talking about episodes 1 and 2 of the team's latest series on John Brookins, who's been in prison for decades for the 1990 murder of Sheila Ginsburg. If you haven't listened to those episodes yet, this conversation may not make a whole lot of sense, so be sure to go back and do that before listening on. Joining me for today's episode is Mark Howard. He's one of the country's leading voices and advocates for criminal justice and prison reform. He's professor of government and law and the founding director of the Prisons and Justice Initiative at Georgetown University. He's also the founder and president of the Frederick Douglass Project for Justice, a nonprofit organization launched in 2020. Mark, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be with you, Rebecca.
Also with us is Marty Tankleff. He's an associate attorney for Metcalf & Metcalf, where he's the head of the Prisoner and Civil Rights Litigation Group. He's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown and Toro Law School. From the time of his release, he has been a zealous and vocal advocate for those who have been wrongfully convicted. He regularly speaks at universities and has also been featured on Oprah, 48 Hours, Discovery ID, and Undisclosed, as long as several online and print interviews. Marty, it's nice to speak with you again.
It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
And finally with us, Colin Miller, one of the hosts of Undisclosed. He's an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and my favorite legal Siri. Hello, Colin. It's nice to speak with you.
Hey, Rebecca. Always great to talk to you.
Well, I just want to give a quick summary of episodes 1 and 2 to remind listeners what's been going on. In episode 1 of this series, the Undisclosed team introduced John Brookins and told his story about returning to Sheila Ginsburg's apartment at about 6 p.m. on December 20th, 1990, to find Sheila's daughter Sharon murdering her. The team then questioned the three witnesses presented by the prosecution at trial that Sheila had actually been murdered in the 11 p.m. hour that night. Episode 2 introduced a new witness who was not presented at trial, Chevelle Durant, who said she was doing laundry at dusk, days before Christmas, when she heard two women arguing over money in Sheila Ginsburg's apartment, followed by a thump and a silence. The Undisclosed team then reported about Sharon Ginsburg giving her mother money from her welfare check to hold for a trip to Florida, as well as a witness who saw a penniless Sharon seeking drugs on the afternoon of the murder, followed by Sharon returning that evening with a roll of money to buy those drugs. Now, Marty, the Undisclosed podcast is all about sharing the stories of the wrongfully convicted. You yourself were wrongfully convicted. For those who don't know your story, what can you tell us about that and what it's prompted you to do in your career?
Sure. So I was wrongfully convicted of the murder of my parents. And in October of 1990, I was sentenced to 50 years to life to be served in New York State prisons. It took me 17 and a half years to finally obtain the evidence that exonerated me. And I was freed on December 27th, 2007. While I was in prison, I made a conscientious decision to say to myself and others that when I got out, I was going to go to law school, I was going to become a lawyer, I was going to fight for those who were wrongfully convicted. 3 weeks after I was released, I was enrolled at Hofstra University, where I finished my undergraduate degree. Thereafter, I went to Toro Law School, where I got my law degree. And I haven't stopped since then. And in 2008, Mark and I were able to start teaching and making an exoneree, which led to kind of the next career path in my life.
Now, Marty, I'm from Long Island, and I grew up in the 80s. I graduated high school in 1991. Your case is very familiar to me. And one of the things I remember about it from then, and then also from reading about and hearing about your story since then, is that like a lot of wrongfully convicted people, as the process and the investigation was kind of drumming on, you, like a lot of people, just thought, I can't possibly be convicted of this because I didn't do it, right?
I mean, that's kind of the inherent belief growing up in the 80s on Long Island. You trusted cops, you trusted prosecutors, innocent people don't get wrongfully convicted. 8 days of jury deliberations, all the lawyers around you saying if it's going 8 days, they have to find you not guilty. Mm. And then the crushing blow occurs. And I was found guilty. And my world shattered. My family's world shattered. And I think the reality that the criminal justice system works shattered right. around me.
Mm. I think, too, at that time on Long Island, too, I mean, this is a little bit of a sidebar, but I remember thinking like a lot of people who were guilty weren't getting convicted. So it definitely, I can imagine that you sort of felt bolstered by the, you know, the evidence. You felt bolstered by the system. I mean, it's really an extraordinary story. I'd suggest to anyone, if they haven't read about or heard Marty Tankleff's story, look it up. It's a fascinating case. And there's a reason why Marty is one of the best known and vocal exonerees in the country. Mark, you are the founding director of the Prisons and Justice Initiative at Georgetown, which is how the Undisclosed team first learned about John Brookins. What is the initiative, and how did you first learn about John Brookins?
Well, first I have to go back to Marty and to yeah. our friendship, because we have known each other since we were 3 years old.
Really?
We went to a place called Lovey Dovey Preschool, and then we went to elementary school, middle school, and high school together.
That's incredible.
We're born 9 days apart, and we've known each other for most of our lives. And so I remember Marty's conviction, and I believed he was innocent, and I actually wrote about it in our high school newspaper, The Purple Parrot, which is the only paper in all of the country that got the story right, which is that Marty was innocent. But when Marty was convicted, especially back then, we didn't know much about wrongful convictions and certainly felt like we couldn't do much about it. I went in a different direction. We joke about it now and say, you know, Mark went to Yale, Marty went to jail. And, you know, I moved on with my life, but I always would tell everybody about my friend in prison who I believed was innocent. And, you know, not many people believed me at the time. But over the years, as the Innocence Project developed, as DNA started to make people aware of the tremendous number of mistakes in the criminal justice system, the numbers of people believing me started to grow. And then I reconnected with Marty. I started visiting him in prison. We developed a really close friendship, where I decided I was going to change my life to help get him out of prison. And at that time, I was already a Georgetown professor of political science, specializing in European politics. But I completely rededicated my life to Marty's case, played a small role, but some role in his exoneration. And then after that, continued on, got my law degree. And now at Georgetown, I founded the Prisons and Justice Initiative in 2016, which has a whole variety of programs for incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people. One of them is the Making an Exoneree program that Marty and I run together, where we have students, undergraduate students. I have to emphasize that because the media always get it wrong and say that they're law students, but where they work reinvestigating wrongful conviction cases. And in 2018, the first year of our program, we were able to contribute to the exoneration of Valentino Dixon. And at that point, a lot of people started to contact us, including John Brookins. And that's when we first heard about his case. We found it very compelling. We decided to take it up in the subsequent year in spring 2019 of our class. And then we were off to the races and really became convinced that John was innocent. And we're so thrilled that Undisclosed has taken it another step further in their investigation. And I'm just so excited for what Colin and his team have been able to put together in the podcast.
I'd love to hear a little bit about what it's like for students being in that class. You know, what is the experience of being a student in that Making an Exoneree class? What kinds of work are they doing? What are they reading about? You know, what is sort of the call to action that they experience in your course?
Well, first off, they have in front of them two professors who have actually lived through a wrongful conviction. And we have 15 students who are working on 5 cases in this given semester. And they are reinvestigating the case from top to bottom. And their goal is nothing short of trying to save an innocent person's life who's languishing in prison. Hmm. And what they have in front of them in Marty is the actual embodiment of that goal. Because if it weren't for people who had tirelessly worked to help Marty, and of course, Marty himself did so much to help himself, but he wouldn't have been exonerated. He wouldn't be out. He wouldn't be teaching this class and contributing tremendously to society the way he is. So our students are motivated every single time they look at Marty, because that's what they're trying to achieve. They're trying to save a person's life and get them out of prison where they don't belong.
Marty, what's that like for you? Because these students aren't much older than you were when you were sent to prison. You were sent to prison at Donnemara, right? Upstate New York?
Well, I served time in Downstate Correctional Facility, yeah. Donnemara, which is Clinton,
Yep.
Auburn Correctional Facility and Comstock or Great Meadow, or also known as Gladiator School.
Yeah, real prisons. And you were a kid, and these kids aren't much older than you were. So do they make that connection when they're talking to you about these cases?
They do. I mean, one of the things that we really expect of our students is for them to grasp the importance of the work they're doing. And by the end of the first class, they do, because before they appear in that first class, they've already had an opportunity to start looking over some of the materials of some of the cases. And they know who the professors are. So obviously, in this day and age, they probably Googled us.
Yep.
And they know something about our backgrounds. And we embody the whole idea that, you know, just the fact that you enrolled in this class and are trying, you're making a societal difference in someone's life that has potentially been ignored or unheard of for years. And we tell every student that there's going to come a point where you're going to get what we call the innocence bug, and you're going to get addicted, and you're going to feel the most rewarding work you can ever do. And there hasn't been a student that's walked away from our class that doesn't want to continue working on a case, that doesn't feel passionate, doesn't say it's the most important class I've ever taken. And we hear that from so many people. We hear that from lawyers that have had an opportunity to work with our students, that recently, even this past semester, we had two lawyers that told Mark and I, don't stop. What you guys are doing are amazing. And the students are so impressive that lawyers are telling some of our students, if you ever need a job, feel free to reach out to us.
You know, it's funny that it just rings so true to me. You know, I started working on the Undisclosed podcast basically just as a consultant like several years ago. I've become busier in my life. I have my own podcast business. I have a day job. I have a lot going on. I will never not work with this show for exactly that reason, because the sort of tangible benefit of doing any kind of contribution to the cause of innocence, it really is a bug. And it really is something every single time I see that yet another person has been exonerated, in no small part because this podcast has elevated their story and made it more public. It's incredibly rewarding. And that's another thing that I think listeners should think about, is ways they can actually work either professionally or as a volunteer to help make that difference.
I mean, so many organizations have exactly that answer on their website. Like, what can you do?
Right.
And I think because that's a question everybody says. They, people say, well, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an investigator, what can I do? And we say you can get involved in their social media platforms. You can get involved in advocacy, reach out to politicians if we're trying to pass legislation. Everybody can do something to make a difference.
Yeah. Absolutely. You can become a podcast producer and help out that way. Now, Colin sends me notes before these interviews, and he sent me a note to ask you about a case of someone named Valentino Dixon, who was eventually exonerated. I'd like to hear a little bit about Valentino Dixon's story. There's always a reason why Colin puts these questions on these notes. So tell me that story. How did this exoneration happen, and how was he wrongfully convicted?
I'll do the backstory. So when I was going to law school, I established a wrongful conviction externship program at the law firm I was at. And at that time, one of the cases that the lawyer worked for, Bruce Barquette, read an article in Golf Digest about this innocent man, or, you know, somebody who was wrongfully convicted, who was claiming his innocence. Bruce started representing Valentino. Our two students investigated his case. I worked with them. I believed in Valentino's innocence. Unfortunately, there wasn't much we could do at that very moment. So I told Valentino, I said, listen, I'm never going to forget about you. If there's come the time where I can help you, I will. In 2018, we presented his case as one of the cases the students could choose to work on.
Did you say Golf Digest, by the way?
Golf Digest.
Okay, just checking.
There's a whole point behind Golf Digest. So Valentino Dixon, when he was growing up, an older relative of his got him into drawing. And he continued that in his life. And while he was in Attica Correctional Facility, he became known as the artist. And I was recently asked about Valentino, about what would have happened if he gave up his drawing. And I said he'd be in prison today. And that's because his drawing led to the superintendent of the correctional facility stopping by his cell one day saying, can you draw a golf course or a hole at the golf course? He said, sir, he goes, I'm a black man from Buffalo who grew up in the hood. I've never been on a golf course before. Lo and behold, his next door neighbor had some golf magazines. And that just started Valentino on his path to drawing golf courses, which led him to writing Golf Digest.
Huh. That's incredible. All right. So talk about how the case was presented in the class and what happened, Mark.
Well, Valentino's case was surreal, although they all are. But in his case, the actual person who had committed the murder had confessed live on television 2 days after Valentino was arrested.
What?
And yet prosecutors dismissed that live televised confession and said, no, we don't need that. We have our guy. It's a classic case of tunnel vision when prosecutors fixate on one person, don't want to say they were wrong. And when any confounding evidence comes in this case, the actual person confessing, they push it away. That same person, Lamar Scott, over the next 27 years of Valentino's incarceration, confessed five different times on camera and kept saying that it was him. And yet Valentino stayed in prison for all those years. Now, what our students were able to do is reinvestigate the case, track down a number of witnesses. It was a crazy scene at 1 a.m. on a street corner in Buffalo with about 70 people present and a feud and a fight broke out and guns in different directions and someone ended up being killed and someone else wounded. And they fixated on Valentino despite the fact that there were a lot of witnesses who said that it wasn't him. And we were able to piece together and put together, working with his lawyer, Don Thompson, a strong case. But the real kicker was that our students did an interview, recorded an interview on camera with the original prosecutor. And they pushed him on the fact that Valentino had said his clothes had been taken into evidence immediately when he was arrested and tested for gunpowder residue, and his hands had been swabbed. And he never heard anything about it. And they pushed him on it, and they actually got the prosecutor to slip up. He got confused. He's now retired. Maybe he's lost a step. And he admitted that it had come back negative, and they never revealed it to the defense. And that's a classic Brady violation.
Yep.
And so that became item number one in his attorney's final motion, his 440 motion based on new evidence that was able to get Valentino out of prison and exonerated. And so I think it's fair to say that without our course and our program and our students, Valentino would still be in prison today. He served 27 years. He's a wonderful person. He's a brilliant artist. He just has a positive spirit. Like Marty, frankly, so many exonerees are some of the most amazing, inspiring people I've ever met. And we're just so lucky and glad that we played a role in helping him achieve his freedom.
And now, I just want to say, what I think is so interesting, too, is you asked about how does it feel to be a young student and for me to come to the class. Imagine the students that worked on Valentino. There was a young man from Japan and two young women from France and England who worked on his case. And the two young women actually flew back and were there the day he got out. So imagine, you know, you being 21 years old, you work on this, you know, case in your last semester, you go back home to your home country, you know, people ask you, so what'd you do over the summer? Well, we worked on this case, and all of a sudden September comes. So, you know, why'd you go back to the United States? Well, the case we worked on over this man that was in prison for 27 years was released because he was innocent. I mean, Valentino Dixon had an international defense team, basically.
He did. And also a defense team with it really is interesting. You know, a lot of the kind of unexpected warriors that come into the wrongful conviction space, a lot of them are people who are motivated by things that are very different than what lawyers are motivated by. Typically, you know, the competitive nature of the law. They're motivated by, you know, the truth. They're motivated by, you know, accomplishing something for all the work that they've put in. And there really is sort of a generosity of spirit there, and almost like, I've got nothing to lose, so I'm not going to stop spirit. You know, they're not billing for these hours. It's fascinating to me to hear stories now of students doing this work too. Colin, we noted that you learned about the John Brookins case from the Making an Exoneree class. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, speaking of unexpected warriors, starting at the beginning, it's that Golf Digest story. We were working on the case of a man named Willie Vesey from Philadelphia, who himself was a great artist. and we posted some of his artwork on Twitter, and a listener said, have you heard of this Valentino Dixon case? This guy has been profiled in Golf Digest, and his drawings are in there. So I read the article. It took me to making an exoneree and finding about the great work that Mark and Marty have been doing and some of the cases they're covering. And so I just very briefly, after reviewing them, pitched them to the undisclosed team. And John Cryer, right, that the actor who you would never expect to have a role in this, is the person who really responded to the John Brookins case and said, African-American man comes upon a white woman being murdered by her daughter, thinks about doing the right thing and calling the police, but then realizes, I'm here alone, a black man with a white woman, they're going to think I'm guilty, and runs away. And he said, this is a compelling story that needs to be told. And so it was really John Cryer who championed this case and got us to take it.
Hmm. Now, Mark and Marty, what was it that initially struck you about the Brookins case that convinced you that you wanted to cover it in your class and bring it to your students?
Well, first we met John's wife, Karen. Karen came to the live event we have at Georgetown after Valentino's exoneration, and she came up to us, and she was so compelling and passionate and also desperate to have someone listen to her story about her husband. And we thought we owed her the courtesy to listen. She had a huge binder. It was like 800 pages. And I
Receipts,
said, can you email
as we
it,
call
please?
Them.
Yeah. And so she sent us the PDF version, which was better. And we went through it and we thought, boy, this is a really compelling case. And then once we ended up taking and digging deeper, I also went with the students to visit John. And that was a really powerful moment because there's something we always call the Marty test, which is Marty has a feel for whether a potential wrongful conviction is real based on his own experience, because he's been through it and he's spent 17 years in prison. And there's this myth that everybody in prison says they're innocent. And Marty says, you know, the people who really are innocent are saying it every single day. They're going to the law library. They're writing letters. They're trying to get anybody possible to pay attention to their case, to work on their case. They're not just sort of, you know, once every 6 months, just sort of shouting out, hey, I'm innocent. They're doing the work. Marty himself, by the way, wrote over 50,000 letters when he was incarcerated. That's a level of dedication to his own case that's extraordinary. And so John absolutely passed the Marty test with flying colors. And then when we started looking more deeply at the case, it became very clear to us that that the daughter was the one who committed this murder, whether, you know, motive, opportunity, means, witnesses, the way in which John's story made sense, even though, of course, it was a complicated situation, and obviously he regrets not having gotten the police involved right away. But we really came to believe in John and thought that we wanted to dig deeper. And then our three students did a fantastic job reinvestigating. And, you know, we consider now we're part of John and Karen's family.
And Marty, John did pass the Marty test. You are completely convinced of his innocence as well, right?
I am. And just to add to that, Karen had actually started to reach out to me almost a year before. She came up to us at the Valentino Dixon event. And for me, what I always say, too, is that exonerees or people who say they're innocent are more defined by their actions than their words. And for people who say they're innocent and are acting on that, going to the law library, like Mark said, reaching out to people, not saying I'm innocent, going out to the yard and playing handball or playing basketball. The fact that John had been doing this for decades and Karen was his vocal advocate on the outside. And then on top of all that, to have Craig Cooley, get involved and represent John. And I've known Craig, he's a former Innocence Project attorney, who I used to sit in on his law classes at Hofstra University when I was doing my undergrad. And I've always said the innocence attorneys, the attorneys that take on these cases, don't take on the cases lightly, because they are so overworked that when they do take on a case, there is a 99.9% belief that someone is innocent. And to have Craig behind John and the Innocence Project behind John and our students, I think it just speaks volumes.
Now, Colin, I was very surprised, you know, in the first episode of this series, because this isn't something that you guys typically do in your reporting of these cases, that you have a suspect, a named suspect, Sharon Ginsburg, Sheila's daughter, right out of the gate. And there seems to be some confidence there that she's the person who actually committed this murder. Has she ever been under investigation or in the press or anything in connection with this crime? Or is the confidence here in saying this, in naming her, just based on evidence that has been uncovered in the reinvestigation of this case?
Sure. She's definitely been in the press. In fact, there's an article reference in episode 3 about 6 witnesses coming forward saying she confessed to the murder. She's in the DNA petition, which we'll get to in episode 4, by Craig Cooley, asking for DNA testing of the items in the apartment. There's a reason why she wasn't further investigated, based upon her connections with the police department that we get into in more detail again in the coming episodes. But there's not a question mark. It's not something where we're proffering something that isn't out there. She, from sort of day one of this case, has been a person of interest and definitely someone who is being considered with his DNA testing as the person who committed the crime.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Colin, as I also noted in the summary, we heard from a new witness, Chevelle Durant, in this case. Where did she come from?
Yeah, this is, you know, following up on Marty being persistent and writing all these letters. The modern version of that is social media works. And so Karen, John's wife, started this change.org petition asking for people to sign and telling the case of her husband. Someone shared that on Facebook, and Chevelle Durant, who thought she would have been contacted all those years ago if she was important, saw this change.org petition and decided to come forward and speak to Karen and myself. And so to all our listeners who always ask, what can we do to help? Just sharing these stories on social media oftentimes can get to people who are important in a case who were never contacted. And that's what led to Chevelle Durant eventually now talking and becoming a potentially vital witness.
Marty and Mark, what was your response to hearing from this new witness who, I mean, on the one hand, she can't pinpoint a day, but on the other, she can say she heard two women arguing over money on Sheila's apartment, followed by that thump soon before Christmas. She, you know, we heard on the podcast the walkthrough. She's able to point to exactly where she was when she heard. It's a compelling and believable piece of testimony. What was your reaction to hearing about this?
Well, I thought it was very exciting. I'm not surprised in that I believe that version of the story. I'm just thrilled that there's a witness who can confirm it. So I think it's a fantastic investigative job that Colin and his team have done to get her to come out and come forward and to tell her version of the story. And I'm thrilled that it matches John's. And I'm hopeful that it will open the door to possible exoneration.
What do you think, Marty?
Well, and sometimes these cases, when you have a witness coming forward 2-3 decades later, you know, the pinpointing the exact date is not as important as what is struck out in their memory. You know, the argument, hearing the thump, that's what's really important. You know, in my case, we had witnesses who couldn't pinpoint the exact date of something, but they said, listen, we may not remember the exact date, but when a witness said something to us that we don't ever expect to hear, you remember that. And I think that's what's so critical about this witness is what she does remember.
And even I just kept thinking that even if she's thinking about a different fight over money in the same proximity of time that, you know, was about give me my money and then hearing a thump, even if that had been the day before, like that is still a compelling piece of testimony that points to Sharon as a really viable suspect. I mean, the memory doesn't have to be perfect to be important, right? I mean, it seems like prosecutors are always taking very imperfect memories and shaping them into that tunnel vision narrative. So why not take an imperfect memory and give it the same weight when it's exculpatory, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, across this country, we also have the ability as defense lawyers to present third-party guilt evidence, that if there's evidence of another party that's potentially guilty, you have the ability to present it to the jury. And when we learn in some of these cases where there's evidence of others who have a motive or there's potential evidence that they were involved, depriving defense lawyers of that information deprives the defendant of his right to a fair trial.
Well, we also heard about Gay Gilliard's testimony, which was missing from the files that even John Brookin's attorney had. I feel like we've heard that story before on the Undisclosed podcast. Unlike Chevelle Durant, Gay is certain she saw Sharon on Thursday, December 20th, first in the early afternoon when she had no money, and second in the evening when she had a roll of cash. Marty, how much does this strengthen John's case beyond what you knew at the time of this case being presented to this class?
You know, everything that happens in wrongful conviction cases, just like John's, it seems the more we investigate, the more information that comes forward, the more evidence of innocence, you know, it takes place. This just keeps building on that. I heard from one lawyer one time that when somebody says they're innocent, continuously, when you keep investigating the case, everything that person has told you ends up panning out. Tragically, it can take decades because some witnesses are afraid to come forward. Some witnesses feel that the information they have is not viable or not relevant. But what I tell people is come forward with anything you think you have, because you don't know what the defense lawyers have. So you may have a very, very small piece to a puzzle that really needs to be put in to get a clear picture. And in every one of these wrongful conviction cases, we see that happening, where we see one person coming forward. And what's amazing is that consistently we see five, six, seven people that don't know each other come forward with consistent information about the core or the central part of the case, which is so critical.
Yeah, I mean, there's no sense that they had colluded, right? Because they're all coming from these sort of different sources. What do you think of this other witness, Mark?
I think it's huge because it is potentially evidence of the actual money that was taken from the victim. And we know that it was over money, and we know that they were arguing over money. We know that Sharon, with her drug habit, desperately needed money and was always going to her mother for money. So it's a very important piece of that puzzle that I think, in a way, completes it potentially. So I'm really excited about it. I think it's a huge discovery.
So, Mark, you talked earlier, and you and Marty both, about people asking what can they do. I'm wondering what specifically can people listening to this podcast right now who want to do something to help John Brookins, what can they do specifically to help in this case? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think for one, sign every petition, follow every social media campaign, support, like, forward, retweet, etc. Another big dimension of this is the parole and clemency process in Pennsylvania, which is very, very difficult. And John has some major supporters in Pennsylvania, including the Lieutenant Governor, John Fetterman, who's fantastic. But it's an uphill battle, both in his county and at the state level, because of the gravity of the crime. What really needs to happen is the DNA testing. And I don't want to go too much further, since I know the last episodes of the podcast will.
Yeah, spoiler alert, Mark. Spoiler
alert. Spoilers. But we really need, well, Colin did one earlier, so I'm not adding anything Colin didn't mention. Being careful. But we really need this case to be reopened. And I think everyone needs to become aware of this and spread the word, sign everything possible, and send a message to the people who can actually make a difference, whether it's prosecutors in terms of testing, or clemency and parole board in terms of John's compassionate release. You know, John has some health conditions. He's been in prison for almost 3 decades, almost 30 years. And I just want everyone just to stop and think about that, what that means. And he has a loving wife. He's a beautiful person. He practices meditation and yoga and healing. He has so much to offer. We need to get him out of prison. And I want people to care for John as a human being, a wonderful human being, and to help bring some compassion into an incredibly cruel criminal justice system.
Final thoughts from you, Marty?
What I say in all of these cases is that if you think you know something, come forward. You know, because so many people may have saw something, and they may have heard something over 3 decades. And quite often, that one little bit of information can tip the tables, can really turn the tables on something favorable. You know, as Mark said, John is an amazing human being. And you have to imagine what 3 decades of fighting is like. You know, in the last few weeks and months, we've seen Ronnie Long get out after 44 years of fighting. There was another gentleman after 37 years of fighting. Valentino Dixon, 27 years. On America's Got Talent, you've got Archie Williams in the finals, who served 36 years. Hmm. And for anybody who thinks that an exoneree can't come out and be a successful member of society, have them go out and meet the exonerees. Have them go to your local innocence projects. Reach out to us. We become some of the most integral parts of our community. We try to help and we try to educate people. And John would do that. Karen would do that. But most importantly, if you know something, reach out to John's lawyer, Craig. You can reach out to me, Mark, Colin, any one of us. Please reach out to us, because there's got to be more information out there. Somebody else knows something in these cases. Even so much as ex-law enforcement that may have been aware of, you know, altering records, withholding of evidence, because we see this in so many of these cases where the most obvious suspects were ignored. Like in my case, my father's business partner fled the jurisdiction, changed his appearance, cleaned out joint bank accounts, well, was ignored. And when you see that, you have to believe that there was something that was going wrong within the law enforcement community at that time.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you guys what a pleasure it has been to speak with you, Mark and Marty. Keep up the good work. Keep inspiring young people to do something to make a difference. And I really hope I get the chance to talk to you both again. Thank you so much for joining me for this podcast.
Thank you, Rebecca. We enjoyed it too.
Thank you, Rebecca, for having us, and keep doing what you guys are doing. It's great.
Yep.
Colin, I'm curious, why do you think the jury convicted John Brookins despite Gay's testimony?
Yeah, we touched upon this a little bit in the episode, but John Brookins had an initial attorney, and that attorney, for reasons we'll discuss, was replaced with, I think, a less competent attorney. And the thing is, Gay Gilliard is certain she saw Sharon on a Thursday. Prosecution gets her to admit she's not certain it's Thursday, December 20th. Couldn't it be the 13th, the 6th, etc.? And it is brought out that Gay Gilliard remembers the next day is the day that Sharon was arrested, which of course is Friday, December 21st. And defense counsel just does not connect the dots and push home to the jury, look, saw her on a Thursday, saw her the next day when Sharon talks to the police. Clearly, this is Thursday, December 20th. And I just think the jury did not make that connection and thought, oh, it could have been another Thursday.
We do have a question from a listener, Jennifer. Jennifer says it was mentioned that Sharon Ginsburg claimed that months after her mother was murdered, that she overheard John confessing to someone that he committed the murder. Who did she claim that John confessed this to? And did this alleged person testify at the trial?
So the answer is yes, we have that person's name. And we have a new interview of him by the private investigator when he is talking about this alleged confession. So we'll cover that in more detail in episode 3 or 4. But yes, we do know who the person is. Sharon herself did not testify at trial. So the one person who implicates John and says, I heard him confess, she's not called by the state. And so that's, of course, very questionable.
We have another listener question. Alani asks, Colin, when they did question John and he told them what happened, why didn't John's attorney pursue the daughter, Sharon, seek DNA evidence, etc.? It makes no sense.
Listen, I previewed it a bit. Mark previewed it a bit. This DNA evidence, it's not just crime scene evidence. There is another vital piece of evidence that when you hear about it, you're going to think, how in the world was this not pursued? And it's a question mark. We're not sure what happened, but we're very hopeful this evidence will be tested now. And if this evidence turns up Sharon's DNA, that's basically game over.
Now, Colin, we heard Mark and Marty talk about their extraordinary class that they're teaching to Georgetown undergrad students. You are a law professor, as we know. Your Twitter handle, of course, is Evidence Prof. You've talked before about your work with your students in the Breonna Taylor case, of course, very much in the news. Can you just talk a little bit about what you and your students have been doing with regard to that case?
Yeah, this was one of our big projects other than the John Brookins case. Breonna Taylor, of course, was shot when police were executing a no-knock warrant in her apartment. And we were working with the attorneys on the case, my students and I, on the civil action against the city of Louisville. And so just as Mark and Marty talk about how their students have this valuable experience, my students getting to work on this case, given everything going on this summer, found it hugely rewarding. And recently the city settled this lawsuit for $12 million. They promised to make significant reforms in the way they execute warrants and mental health services, etc. And so we were thrilled to be able to help that family and do this legal research to A, not give the family justice, they can't get their daughter back, but give them a significant monetary award to at least give them some type of relief, and to help in this nationwide push now to ban these no-knock warrants that are so damaging, especially to communities of color.
We should mention that as we tape this podcast, we're probably about an hour away from news breaking in the Breonna Taylor case. We're waiting to find out if the officers involved in the shooting are going to be charged, right, Colin?
Yes, that's correct. 1:15 or 1:30 Eastern time, we're expecting the grand jury's decision in the case.
Right. So that's very shortly after we'll be taping this podcast. And we can't get your reaction to that in our conversation, but I understand you're going to be recording your reaction to that. And that will be included in this episode at the end of the podcast. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say when that news breaks. But you did mention about the monetary settlement. You know, recently news came out that the city had settled with Breonna Taylor's family, and it was around $12 million, right, that they were awarded in that settlement. What was your reaction to that?
My reaction is the state did not want to turn over discovery, including, we think, body cam footage that exists. And this fits perfectly with this timeline, is the state and the city have been dragging their feet about turning over discovery, saying there's an ongoing criminal investigation. That ends today when there's either a grand jury indictment or not, meaning they would have had to turn over this information. And so it's my firm belief they reached the settlement to avoid discovery, and the family was not going to settle for anything below a significant award. And that's why you see the timing as well as the high amount. They did not want to turn over documents and possibly body cam footage of what happened in this case.
But of course, if the officers are charged and there is a trial, that's likely to come out, right?
Correct, which is why we're hopeful that charges would be brought. But unfortunately, given the shutting down of Louisville as a city, I'm not too hopeful about those charges being brought.
One other piece of news in the case that came out a couple weeks ago, but I feel like was kind of lost in the news cycle, was a plea deal in which it appears that the cops were trying, or prosecutors were trying, to get Breonna Taylor's boyfriend to implicate her in some kind of criminal activity in order to draw a line to perhaps bolster their case that the police weren't doing something they shouldn't have been doing. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because when I heard that on the news, I wasn't surprised, but of course I was shocked. It felt like a gut punch that this alleged attempted cover-up was happening right in front of us. And we hear about this all the time on Undisclosed, about how plea deals are very often used to secure bad evidence against other people. But this is a person who's not under arrest. This is a person who died, who was killed. And I'm wondering if you can just react to that, maybe just explain a little about what happened there and react to that for me.
Yeah, plea bargaining has been the subject of my research for the past few years. And this, in effect, is plea bargaining as fraud, or plea bargaining as coercion. There's no evidence that Breonna Taylor was involved in this drug distribution scheme. There was no reason in the plea deal with the ex-boyfriend to say that Breonna Taylor was involved. They struck a plea agreement with the ex-boyfriends to give him sentencing relief, in which part of the plea deal involves him implicating Breonna Taylor as being involved. It's not pertinent. It's not necessary for the plea deal. It's them knowing they have leverage over the ex-boyfriend, because if he goes to trial, he's going to be punished more harshly. And so they, in effect, coerce him to say Breonna Taylor is involved, because that then is evidence she's involved, which in some way might justify what the police did here. And so it's pernicious. Our system is a plea bargain system. It's not a trial system anymore. And this is blatant evidence of the type of misconduct we tend to see in this plea bargaining process.
And this man came forward, right? He disclosed what had happened to him, right? He didn't have to do that.
Correct. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I know that like the eyes of the country are on this story right now. By the time this podcast comes out, we'll know a little bit more. Of course, we'll hear your reaction later in the show. Colin Miller, I'm really excited to hear more of the Brookins series. Thank you so much, by the way, for including Mark and Marty in this conversation. It was a pleasure talking to them. And of course, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Rebecca. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to this edition of the Undisclosed Addendum. If you have any questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Production for The Addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast, Crime Writers On. Thanks so much to executive producer Methil Telhan and to Colin, Rabia, Susan, and our friend John Cryer for continuing to let me be a part of this important work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. There's a lot more to come next week.
Hi, this is Colin Miller following up with news in the Breonna Taylor case. As this episode drops, most of you likely know, two of the officers involved in the shooting of Breonna Taylor were not indicted of any crimes. A third officer was charged with three counts of wanton endangerment, not based upon any bullets he fired into Breonna Taylor's apartment, but instead for the bullets he sprayed into adjoining apartments. My take is, having worked in this case, I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm mad, I feel terrible for Breonna Taylor's family. The police never should have had a warrant for Breonna Taylor's apartment. She was innocent of any wrongdoing. They certainly should have never had a no-knock warrant. They should not have sprayed bullets into her apartment and adjoining apartments. This is not justice. Unfortunately, it's not something new either. For decades and centuries, grand juries in this country almost always indict civilians. They almost never indict police officers involved in shootings. This disproportionately impacts communities of color, as have no-knock warrants. The only silver lining, if we can find any, is this case has already created an impetus to ban no-knock warrants both in Kentucky and Louisville, as well as across the country. I'm going to do everything, and I call upon you as listeners to do everything we can to have a ban on no-knock warrants across the country to make sure that something like what happened in the Breonna Taylor case never happens again.